Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Other Side of Truth. I'm here with a very special episode and a very special guest. I've got an old friend, Errol Bruce Knapp, on the, I was going to say the phone, but it's not the phone, is it? We're on the Skype system.
Yeah, it's the new technology, mate.
You're just feeding into the stereotypes online when you talk like that.
Well, I just open my mouth and stuff comes from my brain that surprises my ears.
Yeah, the same thing happens to me, which is why I try not to open my mouth quite as much today as I maybe did 4 or 5 years ago. For those who don't know who Errol is, we're going to be talking about his life and a lot of the things that he's done. Most people that might be listening to this or listening to me at least would know him for his work in the UFO field. But Errol has had a long-running radio show called Strange Days Indeed. He had another show called Mind Shift. Didn't run quite as long, but it wasn't about UFOs. It was more about
everything else. All the other woo-woo stuff, yeah.
The woo-woo stuff. You sound like James Randi there. So we'll talk a bit about that. But he's also run, has it been since 1996, the UFO updates list?
1996.
1996. He can still do the radio voice when he wants to. I consider UFO updates to be the single most important online resource if you're studying the UFO phenomenon or if you're studying the cultural phenomenon that is ufology, which is a different thing. And so either or.
I've always said that if you started at archive message number one and made your way through up to date, you would absolutely deserve a PhD in ufology.
And you know who archive message number two is from? I didn't know this until I went in today, and I went all the way back to 1996 in November. Mac Tony's was probably 20 years old at the time, and the message is from Mac Tony's Incorporated. He was one of my three or four best friends, and I met him through UFO updates. So without you, I never would have known, probably never would have known Mac Tony's, and I might not have known Greg Bishop or Nick Redford, my other fellow cabal members quite
happy
as well.
Happy to take the credit for all three. My first computer was an Atari, and we used to get, and I'm sure you did out there in Nova Scotia too, we used to get free computer newspapers. And I wanted to know about UFOs. I'd had some strangeness in my life in the past. And going through the classifieds in the computer, one of the computer newspapers we got here, there was an ad that said, the UFO Intelligence Network, and it was a BBS, a bulletin board system. And there was a telephone number, and I called, and I had an Atari and a modem. And I called the guy, and he said, yeah, it's $40 a year. So I signed up, and all I could find was the MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, FIDO Network, and there was one other network covered UFOs. But it took 2 or 3 days for a message that I wanted to contribute to what they were called conferences. So I would post something, you would get it 2 or 3 days later via the bulletin board network. Then when the time came to get rid of my Atari and buy a PC and go online, still running an Atari-based BBS called UFO Updates in Toronto, I wanted to find something the equivalent, and there were all of these news groups. I got an email program called Eudora, which I still use to this day for updates and for all my email, and started the email list with just half a dozen people and still called it UFO Updates. So it was a matter of my curiosity needed to be fed and not by the idiots out on the news groups. And there were several people out there on the news groups like Chris Rutkowski in Winnipeg. They were just having an impossible time having any sort of rational discussion. There will always come a point in the discussion on UFO updates where I as a moderator need to step in and either not post what's been submitted or kill the topic or sometimes just banish people.
So let's travel back in time. You were born in Alexandria in the middle of the war, weren't you?
In Egypt, yeah. Yeah, my dad was a Canadian who was with the British Army, and he met a lovely 10th generation Greek girl in Egypt.
You certainly would have been too young to remember the Battle of El Alamein.
I was born to the sounds of the guns of El Alamein, apparently.
Really?
Because my mother was giving birth to me.
Did you ever talk to your parents about what it was like to be in Egypt, you know, as the Africa Corps was coming and you're giving birth to a kid?
Oh, yeah. The whole thing about my mother and dad was they wanted to get married, and the Brits had just taken Egypt from the Germans. And so she was the resident of an enemy country. So they weren't allowed to get married unless she was pregnant. So they were married in August of 42, and I was born in October of 42.
So is the punchline to that that you exist on this earth solely so that your parents could get married?
I'm a love child. Love child.
Oh, very nice. Well, considering that you know, began your career in the 60s, that just fits.
Yeah, well, my mother and I were shipped out of Egypt in 44 and arrived in London, England, just in time for the air raids. And I remember very clearly looking out over London from a third or fourth floor window and seeing all of these socks tucked into one another floating in the sky on string, barrage balloons, mini airships that they suspended on cables to get in the way of bombers as they came in on low runs. I remember it very, very clearly. I guess because of the explosions that accompanied those images. I also remember my mother and grandmother bent over me in my little stroller because there was an air raid going on and they were shielding me, screaming. Odd how things stick.
So how long were you did you live in England after the war?
My dad was in the British Army until 1964. You know, he was married, had a couple of kids, and when his stint was up, he just signed up again and stayed and ended up as a British Army Sergeant Major. And when he finally retired from the Army, he became the first Canadian to be a beefeater in the Tower of London.
The fact that your father was a Sergeant Major in the British Army, does that have anything to do with your inclination to moderating UFO updates with an iron fist?
Yeah. Yes. Some of it rubbed off. Yeah, I thought it was more sort of not necessarily kid gloves, but maybe alligator skin gloves.
Highly illegal these days. You should know better than using alligator skin gloves.
I thought it was ivory mostly that was illegal.
It'd be hard to get a pair of ivory gloves, although maybe.
Ivory gloves. Articulated.
Yes, like Skeletor or something.
Mm-hmm.
So you stayed in England, which would explain the accent.
I traveled back and forth. 1945 to 1948, we went to Gibraltar, where I heard the story about the United States Army Air Force, the Roswell story on the Beeb. I actually heard that, which first intrigued me, and I thought, oh, flying saucers? And my dad was an avid reader, wanted me to read, so he took me to the library and we tried to find books on flying saucers, and there weren't any. But there was lots of things on ghosts and paranormal.
I wonder if you went and asked people who were interested in these things, how many of them would say it was their parents that actually kind of encouraged them to read, and these just happened to be the books that were available. Did your dad have an interest in the paranormal?
Sort of, kind of, but no. He was a voracious reader. He would read four or five books a week all his life. And was a poet. Wrote limericks, won competitions here. Who's the humorist, the Canadian humorist? Stephen Leacock. Yeah, he won, I think, a couple of times Stephen Leacock Award for limericks.
Your iron fist moderating comes from your father, and your artistic bent comes from your father, too, apparently.
Yeah, yeah, he played the accordion, the harmonica. I mean, he was also, he loved acting. He was always in whatever drama group was happening wherever we were posted. So 1948, went back to the UK, spent 3 years there, and in 1952, we went to Egypt again, but with the British military. And in fact, I got sunstroke at Queen Elizabeth's coronation parade at the Air Force, Royal Air Force Field in Faid, sitting in the sun for too long.
Was your dad still stationed there? Were they still there when the whole Suez crisis blew up, or had he moved on?
We were actually shipped out of normal army tours of 3 years. Halfway through, we were shipped out of there to Cyprus. And my dad ended up in the army as an oxymoron, military intelligence. In fact, we went from the frying pan into the fire because he was at an army barracks in the middle of Nicosia, the capital of Cyprus. And one day, because he was always journalisting for whatever British newspaper was in the neighborhood, he'd gone out and bought himself a little portable typewriter, and he was duty officer that night, and he put it in a metal locker up against the outside wall of the barracks, brick wall. And while he was off duty officering at about 10 o'clock at night, an Ioka terrorist bomb went off right outside his office and blew the wall down and blew shrapnel through his brand new typewriter, which he wasn't impressed by.
Beats having it blown into your leg or...
Yeah, he was somewhat pissed off about it, though, because military wages weren't that hot and he'd saved a long time to get himself a new typewriter.
And I'm assuming the Royal Army didn't offer to buy him a new one.
No, there was no insurance on personal belongings. After Cyprus, we went back to the UK, up to Scotland, outside Perth, a little place called Scone, S-C-O-N-E, which is where the stone of Scone comes from that's in the British throne, or under the British throne. And Scottish nationalists, and just everywhere we went, there was bother, mate. Lots of bother.
They were still there when I lived there in the late 1980s, so
mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're still there now.
Yeah. A couple of who were my dad's mother and dad's best friends were Scottish nationalists, and it was amazing they were friends, but they were. So at 15, things started to get a little difficult for me at home, my dad being a sergeant major, and so because I had been to so many schools, I think 21 in all, I got streamed out of the educational system at 15. So my dad said, well, you move out, get a job, or join the army. And I said, okay, I'll join the army. I know how to do all of that stuff. I was 15. So I went away and went to the Army Apprentices College in Harrogate and spent 3 years there learning how to become a telegraphist. Morse code, wireless, telephone switchboards, teletype. And at 15, which I was when I went into the military, I was allowed to sign 3 years as an apprentice, 9 years with the regular army, and 3 years with the reserve. At 15, I was allowed to do that, which was very nice of them, I thought.
Did you have to get parental consent for that, or did...
Of course, yeah. My dad was very proud. My kid brother, Wesley, went to the Duke of York's Royal Military School when he was 11 and ended up in the Royal Marines.
So I'm doing the math here, and I have to admit that math is not my strong suit, but if you joined at 15, which would make it 57, and you were to do three... You couldn't have done a full 9 year stint because you were doing pirate radio.
Bingo.
So
my 21st birthday, I am in Libya, in Benghazi, a name that would probably be familiar to many now. And I woke up after my 21st birthday bash and thought, what the hell am I doing here? I'm 21 and I have another 8,000 years to serve Her Majesty. And I thought, I'm not going to do this. So I was playing in a rock and roll band. Lots of stories about life in Benghazi. But I did very little work for the military. I ran the guys' social club, and money that we made from the social club, we bought instruments, and we started a rock and roll band. And so what I decided to do, that was October, was to have a nervous breakdown, because it was the only way that I could get out of the Army. You know, because of the work that I was involved with, I was valuable to them. Our band was booked to play the New Year's Eve dance of the 14th, 20th King's Hussars, who were part of the charge of the Light Brigade. And so we went and played, and right after Auld Lang Syne, we were playing dance music, and I kicked my drum kit all over the stage and lay screaming on the floor. And they took me away to the hospital and military hospital and kept me in a darkened room for 2 or 3 days. And oh, what's going on? And they said, "You had a nervous breakdown, lad," they said. And I said, "Oh, really?" "But that means that I'm not going to be allowed to stay in the Army." "Well, we're sorry, but in the job that you're doing, you can't have a nervous breakdown." But I want to be here." And then they flew me to a military hospital in Cyprus. And from there, you know, telling me that they're going to get rid of me, and I'm protesting. And from Cyprus, they flew me to the lunatic hospital for military personnel. And one evening, my name appeared on orders to go before the medical board. And the next morning, I went in there and as a soldier. And 3 minutes later, I came out as a civilian.
So the scam, and, you know, I think it's safe to say it was a scam, right? You didn't actually.
Yeah, that's, you know, it was the only way I could get out.
So you outsmarted the British Army.
Yes. I got a job immediately in Leicester Square working with the Automobile Association. It was a breakdown service. People could call in, you know, subscribers. But they also had a radio center where some of the really nifty workers could work, and it was called the Rainbow Network, and it was for MPs. You know, they all had two-way radios in their car, and it was before the days of security the way it is now over there. And so I did that for about 4 months, and then I always fiddled with radio, and I came across this new radio station that was called Radio Caroline. When I happened on it, the disc jockey who was on air said, "Well, we need some more people out here to work on the radio, so if you got any experience or you'd like to make a tape and send it to Caroline House in London." And I thought, oh, cool. One of the things that I loved doing was I was the first kid on my block with a real tape recorder and did radio plays and stuff in Cyprus doing that. And so I made a tape and went to do my night shift at Feynham House in Leicester Square for the Automobile Association on the Sunday night. And the Monday morning after my shift, I showed up at 6 Chesterfield Gardens, Radio Caroline's headquarters in London, and sat on a step waiting for someone to show up. And this first someone that showed up was Alan Crawford, who was Ronan O'Reilly's partner, an Australian guy. And he said, "Hello, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Please, sir, I brought my tape." And he said, "Oh, I didn't know. Anyway, come on up." So he took me up to his corner office, sat me down, put the tape on and said, "Yeah, that's not bad." And the phone rang. And there was a guy, when Radio Caroline first started, pirate radio on ship off the coast of the UK, that was the only thing that there was to listen to other than the BBC, which was awful, and in the evening Radio Luxembourg. So I'm sitting there, the man has said he likes my tape, phone rings, and the only guy who could operate the board, the turntables and the microphones and all of that stuff, had been taken off the ship with appendicitis by a lifeboat. And the guys that were on there were all very mellifluous voices and, but they hadn't got a clue about operating. So I was shipped out that very day to the ship. And before too long, I was working on the radio as a disc jockey and talking to, 28 million people.
Let me get this straight. I'm going to summarize for our listeners here. You left school at 15 because, I'm just going to paraphrase, you didn't fit in, went into the Army where they trained you in a whole bunch of technical things, got yourself out of the Army by pretending to be slightly mad and having a breakdown, wound up in Leicester Square, and then used the technical skills that the Army had given you to join perhaps one of the most anti-establishment outfits going at the time, Pirate Radio, because they needed somebody with the technical skills that the Army had given you. Does that pretty much sum it up?
Yeah. I mean, that's another way of looking at it.
Well, no, it makes you a rebel with a cause. I assume you eventually acquired a cause, but...
I don't know that I ever did.
Causes are overrated, man. It's all about having fun.
Yeah, well, I certainly did that.
So maybe for folks who don't know what pirate radio was, you could, give a short explanation of just what pirate radio was, because I think there was a movie put out a year or two or three ago, right, with Philip Seymour Hoffman was in it, wasn't he? I think, which was apparently not very good. I didn't see it.
It was bloody awful. The producers had spent months talking to former pirate radio disc jockeys, got the real story, and then went away and made that awful movie. There are only, I guess, three things that were accurate about that movie. It was a radio station on a ship. The music of the era was accurate, except for the Beatles, because they couldn't get a hold of the rights. And what was the third thing? People were seasick. It was just made up stuff. Pirate radio came about because the Australian guy that I was talking about a little while ago, Alan Crawford, had a little record label in London that covered the West Indian music scene. Blue beat, ska. But he couldn't get any airtime anywhere on the BBC or Radio Luxembourg. Radio Luxembourg was an evening operation out of the Duchy of Luxembourg that broadcast in English usually from about 7 till 3 a.m. And all of the airtime there was bought by all the big record companies. And they had these disc jockeys that played their music. Carnival Records was the name of the label. Carnival Records couldn't get any airtime anywhere. And then Crawford heard about a woman who had a couple of ships with radio stations on them off the coast of Sweden and Norway, Radio Nord and Radio Sud. And they had been put out of business by one of those governments there. And the ships were available. Crawford didn't have any money, so he went to the city of London and met this Irishman named Ronan O'Reilly, whose dad owned back in those days, Gurnor Harbor in Southern Ireland. And Ronan's family was fairly well off. And Ronan thought it was a great idea to, buy one of these ships and start a radio station along with Crawford. So they planned to put this radio station on the air. And what Crawford didn't know was that Ronan O'Reilly went behind his back and raised the money for the second ship. And got his station, long story, but got his station on the air first. So there were these two radio stations within 2.5 miles of one another, 3.5 miles off the UK coast in international waters as they were then. And they couldn't be touched by the British government, but broadcasting music from dawn till dusk and playing all kinds of music that the BBC never played. They couldn't play a lot of recordings because from the very beginning they'd had a deal with the musicians' union about how much needle time they could use. In the 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the 60s, there was always this live music with live musicians on air on the BBC. So the pirates had no such restrictions and really very quickly became huge, to the point where they were influencing all kinds of things, record sales. And it was right at the, swinging 60s in the UK. Carnaby Street and the Mods and all of that stuff.
how far did the pirate radio stations reach? Like, if you were living in Manchester, would you hear them, or Glasgow, or, you know, how far did the reach for the stations
into
go?
Into the country, probably as far, decent signal as far as Birmingham. So eventually the two stations, Radio Atlanta and Radio Caroline, named after Caroline Kennedy, merged, and Radio Atlanta stayed where they both had been as Radio Caroline South. And then the other ship, the Frederica was the name of the ship, sailed transmitting all the way around Pointy Bit on the left-hand side of the UK and round and off the Isle of Man, and became Caroline North.
And so you stayed with Caroline South, I guess, or the main one?
Yeah. I did time on Caroline North as well. But yeah, so I stayed with Caroline South for a couple of years.
What would they do? Would they say you're going to do, say, a 3 or 4 day? Were you 3 or 4 or 5 days on, and then you'd come back to the mainland, or were you and you lived on the boat?
Sort of, kind of. We were on the ship 2 weeks and then 1 week off, if the weather was good, and the tender could get alongside to bring on the other guys so that you could get off.
What would happen? I imagine the weather might have been okay in the summer, but were you? I assume you would be working in the fall and the winter, and
yeah, there was a lot of ugliness. We had double anchor chains that went down to a spinner, and then huge chains that went out to concrete blocks on the seabed to hold her in place. So you get a force 10 gale, and the waves would come and pick her up to the very length, the fullest extent of the anchor chain, at which point she would bang against that and then plunge down the valley between the waves. It got to be fairly ugly. I mean, there's all kinds of stories, you know, from that, but we'd put pennies on the tone arms that the stylus that sat on the record to hold it down when it got really, really rough.
Did you ever bring any musicians?
Yes.
Or performers out to the boats for sort of an in-studio session?
Yeah, there was one famous event which when Jimmy Smith, the organist, jazz organist, came out and played a Hammond B3 on the live on deck. And then, you know, they would bring out, you know, various singers and mostly nice, tasty birds. Dolly birds. Little Mardi girls who happened to have hit singles. It was a popular destination.
So we have a G-rated show here, so I'm not going to ask necessarily what may or may not have gone on.
A lot went on, unlike in pirate radio.
Yeah, I didn't see the film, so I don't know what they... See, and now I'm not going to. Why would I watch a film when I can talk to a guy who actually did it?
Yeah, well, it's like, ew, this tastes awful. Taste this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, well, exactly. Yeah, there was a lot of indignation about that movie. And, you know, it would have been wonderful to make a decent docudrama about it. But it's been, you know, oh, no, it's been done now. We don't want to do another one.
What people might not know is that you didn't, I'm looking at the, I think it's the Pirate Radio Hall of Fame website.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to post a link to this, offshoreradio.co.uk. And you didn't go by the name of Errol Bruce Knapp on the show.
No, just Errol Bruce, yeah.
And your nickname apparently was Boss Cat.
Yeah. That was on Radio England. That was later on the American powerhouse stations. Two radio stations on one ship. One was Top 40, the other one was middle of the road. Yeah, Boss Cat. That came about, they had a jingle package, That Man, as rather like Batman, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, it's That Man. And we were all Boss Jocks. The Boss Jocks, play more music, pow. I have all of those jingles if you really want them.
Yeah, no, send me one. I'd love to add this, you know, here we have 2 seconds of silence, and then I'm going to pop in one of those jingles. I love stuff like that. Like, I'm time shifting here instead of following a linear thing, but I did want to ask you, seeing how you were there in the sort of halcyon days of independent radio,
mm-hmm.
Do you listen to modern radio?
All I listen to is CBC. And then I listen to and watch a lot of TwitTV, twit.tv, which is This Week in Technology. No, I can't stand radio. Any of the commercial stuff is just pablum. And, you know, we're still playing music from 40 years ago, and every station plays the same stuff. And the people who are working on air know nothing. The computer tells them what to play. It's crap. And it's just such a useless use of public airways.
You maniac! You blew it up! Damn you! God damn you all to hell!
You're preaching to the converted here.
There, you see, you got me started now. You got all riled up, you young whippersnapper.
It's one of the things I wanted to talk about, because in my business, one of the things that's really hurt documentary makers, but I think hurt television in general and films in general, but I think it's also hurt music, which is my old business, having been a musician for years, is media consolidation.
Yeah.
So when you started, pirate radio was really rebelling against the sort of media consolidation of just the mother corp, the Beeb. Yeah. And then you went through maybe 20 or 30 years, or even 40 years, of diffusion of the media so that you had many different outlets doing many different things. And yet the last 10 years has seen them basically coalesce again, even in the private sector, yeah, into five or six megalithic international super corporations that control music, television, film, radio, all of it.
Especially in the States, there's very little local radio anymore. You know, it's all voice tracked, or it comes down the wire from the satellite. And they do drop-ins of local bits and pieces, but the heart has gone out of radio. It doesn't entertain. It's just background hum now. There's nothing of value on radio anymore, with the exception of CBC. And maybe a couple of independents. And certainly a lot of the online stations now, there's wonderful stuff out there.
When you were back there in the 60s as a swinging, rocking, mod dude.
Yeah.
What kind of music were you playing on your show?
All the Motown stuff. Four Tops, Marvin Gaye, Supremes, Martha and the Vandellas, all the Stax Volt stuff. Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, Sam and Dave, Booker T and the MGs, British-wise, Beatles, Stones, Animals, Dave Clark Five, all in its heyday. You know, nobody'd heard of Motown until Caroline came along and started playing it. You know, yes, you know, some of the guys who lived near Liverpool or any of the commercial ports who had friends who were merchant seamen, they would bring stuff across the Atlantic, bring 45s over, but that was it. There was no way to plug into any of that music. Nobody knew about it until we came along.
So I suppose the question that you have to ask for anybody from that era, or even from my era, is, were you a Beatles guy or were you a Stones guy? Understanding that you would have liked both, but which one were you more inclined?
I loved them both. I had been in Hamburg in the army when these Scouts Gits, these Liverpool boys, were playing there.
Did you actually?
Oh yeah, hung out.
I think you remember telling me that you knew some of the Beatles or all of the Beatles.
Yeah.
But I can't remember which. You did say you knew one of them or maybe two of them better. But I just can't remember which one.
I knew both Lennon and McCartney. I had run John and Yoko's Peace Station Network here in Toronto when the ill-fated Toronto Peace Festival was being put together. I was their Peace Station Network coordinator. So knew John fairly well, knew Keith Richard and Mick Jagger fairly well. You know, I was a pirate radio disc jockey. I was playing their music. I was going to the clubs that they were going to. So we got to know one another. They were just a bunch of guys like me.
So how long did you do pirate radio in the United Kingdom?
64 to 68.
And when 68 rolled around?
Well, they were being, you know, the writing was on the wall and they were going to disappear eventually. So I thought, well, I'm a Canadian citizen, although I'd never been there. I might as well go to Canada.
So before we move to the Canadian part of your journey, final word on pirate radio. What kind of influence do you think pirate radio had on both music, but also on, you know, our end of the street, the media industry?
Huge. No doubt about it. Influential with the music. If the record companies would send us out promo release 45s with a big A on one side, and we play both sides, and if we didn't like the A side, we'd play the B side and make it a hit. Really upset the record companies. But it was, you know, that was the power then. Nobody said, hey, you have to play this, don't play that. We all would take stuff out to the ship that we wanted to play. When the British government finally moved to shut the pirates down, it was very apparent that unless there was a substitute, a replacement for pirate radio, there would be a major hassle from the population. So BBC One was founded, which was staffed by former pirate disc jockeys. So it made a difference to the media there. And as a result of that, 3 or 4 years after I left, then commercial radio, local commercial radio became a reality in the UK.
Okay, pirate radio, folks. I mean, I did college radio, and we thought that was cutting edge, and we were rebellious and everything. Mm-hmm. And I suppose in the 80s, maybe we were. It was where you were going to hear REM or U2 before you heard it. Well, I wasn't playing. I was in junior high when U2 came out. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I was in college playing the band, like Hot House Flowers, a British band, you know, you'd hear it first on college radio, and then eventually they might seep into the public consciousness.
Yeah.
But nothing compared to what you guys were doing. You were on a boat. I was in the Student Union building.
Oh, it was a great adventure. I tell you, it was hysterical. Historical, yeah.
Very Lennon-esque, very nice, very Liverpoolian.
Yeah.
As Mionti used to say.
Yeah, so I arrived here in 1968, talking funny, in Toronto, and Keith Hampshire, who had been a pirate radio DJ, Canadian, from Calgary originally, was here, and he was working for Foster Hewlett's radio station in Toronto, CKFH, built on the fun money made from hockey. And I arrived here, gave him a call, and eventually I got a job doing overnights at CKFH. And still talking funny, but playing. The show was called Where It's At, and it was all that era's R&B. And I gradually worked in blues and started playing white blues. And it became a stoner radio show. And all the brothers would phone me and say, hey, man, how come you know so much about our music? Because I'd worked in pirate radio in the UK and clubs. I was also a club disc jockey there.
So you're in Toronto doing radio now.
Spent some time working at CKFH. Got dumped by a beautiful woman that I was really quite in love with and ran away to Tucson, Arizona. The morning we were driving into Tucson, there was a very excited disc jockey on one of the radio stations. They were saying, here's a new one by the Fab Four, the Beatles. This is Get Back. So the day that JoJo left his home in Tucson, Arizona, I arrived.
Synchronicity.
Yeah.
People make fun of me because I like synchronicities. I just find them interesting. So we'll call it a coincidence to keep my critics happy.
Yeah.
So were you just visiting Tucson, Arizona? Or?
Oh, I ran away from Toronto. The beautiful woman that I was in love with in Toronto did the last series of commercials for Benson and Hedges cigarettes. Also did billboards and bus stops and back ends of buses. She'd gone down to Acapulco. It was a black and white shoot. And this lovely white horse in the white sand and this tall, willowy, just gorgeous brunette. And she came back from Acapulco and said, I can't see you anymore. And then disappeared. I couldn't find her anywhere. And then suddenly, everywhere I looked, there she was. In the newspapers, on billboards, on the backs of buses, on the tops of cabs, television. And I had to get out of town. I quit my job and ended up going down to Tucson, Arizona, ostensibly to work on Barry Goldwater's partner's new FM radio station.
What kind of music was Barry Goldwater's partner's new FM radio station playing?
Well, the AM was playing Mexican music, but the FM was going to be progressive, the way Chum FM was back in the day when I arrived in Toronto. So anything that the mind of the man on the, or woman on the radio could muster.
So the arch-conservative Barry Goldwater was at least loosely affiliated with an FM radio station that was playing very progressive music.
Eventually did, yeah.
I suppose he's a conservative, anything to make money.
Yeah. I had a blast down there, apart from being desperately sad and unhappy, because they'd seen him on the television, but they'd never actually had one in amongst their midst. Limey!
I suppose you would have been quite exotic, wouldn't you?
Yeah, yeah. Strikingly handsome.
you still are.
Well, I don't know about that, but yeah, a bit jowly and saggy and baggy around the eyes, but not bad for an old geezer. Yeah, so I had a wonderful time down there in reality, and then had to come back because John and Yoko needed me up here to do their Peace Station Network thing.
So what was the peace thing like?
After the Bed In for Peace, there were some promoters here in Toronto who brought him in for the Pop 69 concert at Varsity Stadium in Toronto. And there were meetings that went on, and they decided that they wanted to run a peace festival, the Toronto Peace Festival. And everybody and their dog was going to play it. I mean, it was a phenomenal lineup. And after the Bed In for Peace in Montreal, Cashbox and Billboard, the two major music weeklies out of the States, had offered John and Yoko a full page ad of whatever they wanted. And it was, you know, war is over, happy peace, yada yada, and join the Peace Station radio network. And they needed somebody to put that coordinate and put that together, so that was my job around the Toronto Peace Festival. And the problem was with there were just so many loonies got involved with the Peace Festival. You know, the Martians are going to come in giant spaceships, and it all fell apart. And that's when John wrote Instant Karma. And the name of the production company was Karma Productions. So they disassociated and the whole thing fell apart. And then a couple of the promoters did the peace train across the country.
Let's talk a bit about your time with Chum in Toronto and all that sort of stuff. And then we can switch it into the UFO paranormal stuff.
Okay. When I arrived in Toronto, I came bearing the latest LPs from the UK. Brian Auger and Julie Driscoll, Crazy World of Arthur Brown, Small Faces, Ogden's Nut Gun Flake. And I wanted to work at Chum FM. So within a week of arriving, I went into Chum on Yonge Street in Toronto with my albums and said, hi, my name's Errol and I'm from the UK and I'm former pirate disc jockey and And I got these records you might be interested in. They went, oh my God, give us copies. Which I did, and they said, well, we don't need anybody right now, thank you. And away I went. And that's when I called Keith Hampshire and ended up working at Foster Hewitt's radio station doing overnights. And then a few years later, probably 10 years or so, I was working at TV Ontario on a series about the digital revolution called Fast Forward. We were the team that put Fast Forward into the English lexicon because we had a video that broke up each segment of the show with a Fast Forward in video. And was working there, and Peter Griffin, who is a famous broadcaster in Ontario anyway, was a neighbor of mine. And he said, why aren't you working in radio now? And I said, well, I'm doing TV and I'd like to get back into it. So he went into the station and talked to, I think it was Warren Cosford, and they had me come in and do a demo tape, which I did, and I ended up doing overnights at Chum FM. So I ended up working at Chum for a couple of years, and then You Light Up My Life came into the control room, and I left. It's plain. You light up my life, you give me strength. Debbie Boone, oh my God. On Chum FM, we're playing Debbie Boone.
Ugh.
So then I did a lot of corporate show business for a long time, using a live animated cartoon process for corporate sales meetings and trade shows and exhibitions. And I drove these little cartoon characters.
Going back a bit, your television work, fast forward, but there was another show you were involved in too, right?
There were actually several. After the Toronto Peace Festival collapsed, I ended up, along with Johnny Stocker, who was a well-known commercial voice in Toronto, he became that. He and I worked together writing as Errol John because it was a non-union gig on the hilarious House of Frightenstein.
That's the one I was thinking of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really ugly. We had to, it was Randy Dandy, Randy Markowitz, who was an earlier incarnation of children's television in the younger days. He and his brother had this idea for Frightenstein, and we would go in, and we had to stay until John and I wrote 10 openers and 10 closes every day.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like a puppy mill, you know?
That would explain why it was a non-union gig, because there's no way you could afford to do that.
No, no. And we both needed the work. So did that for a while. Did many things, you know.
So when you were writing for the hilarious House of Frightenstein in a non-union gig, I'm assuming that the concept of royalties and all that other sort of nice stuff.
No, there was a guy got in touch with me, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago, who said he was working on behalf of various people that had worked on various aspects of the show, wanting to get some sort of royalties. And the rights to the show had been sold so many times that there was no way, even if we went to the original production company, we would have gotten anything. Nobody did from back in those days.
No, I noticed it was airing on Space, I think. They were showing the reruns of it. I don't know if they do it now, but a couple of years ago, at least, they were showing, you know, at 7 in the morning on weekday mornings kind of things. What is old is new, and what was once really cool for kids, and then, this is horrible. Now it's hip again.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this, I'm sure it was college students on high on marijuana or something, going, this is the greatest, like SpongeBob. This is the greatest thing ever. We've been up all night getting high, and it's 7 o'clock in the morning, and we can watch these crazy, this vampire guy.
Yeah.
So you were a writer on the hilarious House of Frightenstein.
Yep.
That might be the coolest thing you've ever done.
Oh.
I'm just kidding. But it is pretty cool.
The original concept of that show was that Guy Big, who played the little count, remember the little guy?
Oh, yeah.
In his uniform, outfit, he was supposed to be the count and not Billy Van. But poor Guy couldn't do it, couldn't carry it. He wasn't an actor.
And nobody could ever understand what he was saying.
Anybody who's listening to this who's not a Canadian will probably go, what the hell are they talking about?
Well, just go to Google and Google it, and you'll find all kinds of stuff on YouTube.
I would just say picture SCTV for kids.
Yeah.
And the Count Floyd segment from SCTV with a green vampire.
Yeah.
You pretty much get the idea of what the hilarious House of Frightenstein was.
And then the other TV show that I worked on, was The All Night Show, before there was All Night TV in Canada. The concept was that there was an out of work actor who got a job as a security guard at, one of Toronto's TV stations. It eventually became Omni, but it was Channel 47, MTV, Multicultural Television. It was a UHF station. And on his tours of duty around the station in the basement, he found all these old TV shows. Outer Limits, Twilight Zone, Car 54, People Are Funny, I Married Joan, and all kinds of just astounding clips, films, cartoons, just stuff. So he got in touch with his friend Ryerson DuPont, who was a TV tech at another station. And between them, the opening of the show was always the station went to shut down, the national anthem would play, and somebody would switch the projector off, and it would na 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 click, fade to black. And then the next thing you would see was a studio camera with a lens cap being lifted off it, and there was a guy in a security guard uniform in a TV control room. And he had an old 3/4-inch video player, sat at a switcher, had a pile of tapes, and would do live TV, dropping in all these old TV shows and cartoons and wonderful stuff. There are clips of it online. The All Night Show, Chuck the security guard and his sidekick cameraman Ryerson, and I was his sidekick Scottish cameraman. He and I would sit down and play the blues, but you would only see from my shoulder out. So, you know, we had a wonderful time. And it was really what started all-night TV in Canada, because the only time TV went all night was CTV, Channel 9 CFTO, out of Toronto, who played movies on a Saturday night all night, and that was it. And Chuck, the security guard, became huge in the city. It was all word of mouth. I think first night we were on, the owner of the station came in and discovered he was at home watching his TV and saw that his station was on the air doing strange stuff. So he came into the station and, what the hell is going on here?
I hang out with a lot of young actors in their 20s, and they are not of the generation that I am, where you would remember the television literally going off the air. And so for those who were wondering what Errol was doing, he was sort of singing the Canadian national anthem, and
yeah,
it would be pictures of Newfoundland and all across the country, and the Canadian national anthem was, and then the test pattern came, beep, and, you know, join us tomorrow morning kind of thing. But I remember watching War of the Worlds on the original film from the 50s on CBC one night, and trying to stay awake to see how it ended when I was a kid, and then, you know, it ended, and that was it. Then the national anthem and the test pattern.
Mm-hmm. And then...
So the segue into the UFO stuff is, you're doing television, you're doing radio, you're working for Chum. How did you convince anybody to air a show about unidentified flying objects, which became Strange Days Indeed?
The January before Roswell, Scott Robbins, who's an old Chum FMer, and myself, we had produced a CD about UFOs, and it was a mind movie. We originally wanted to be on a stereo radio station, so you put the headphones on and move it left, right, behind you, over your head, and it was pretty good damn production, actually. And we went to a couple of potential stations, and nobody was interested. Great demo! Ah, it's so good, but we can't use it. And eventually, Bob Mackiewicz, who was the music director at Q107, another station here in Toronto, CILQ-FM, that I'd also worked at, was the program director for CFRB, also in Toronto. And Gene Mascardelli, who was the exec producer of Strange Days Indeed, ran into Macko, and Macko said, what's Errol doing? And, oh, he and Scott had just done a demo. So Macko took it and liked it a lot and said, well, why don't you come here and work for a couple of months for free and we'll see how it goes. So Scott Robbins and I went in and we did the first show and wasn't bad. And then Robbins decided that he was getting into multi-level marketing and off he went to the States and then eventually to Mexico and left me doing talk radio all by myself. I'd never done talk radio. What? No records, no CDs. I managed somehow with a lot of umming and ahhing. I hated live radio. I was so happy to do podcasts where I could just clean my act up. Ah.
Yeah, no, it's great. I love it too, actually. When we were doing Ghost Cases, I had a rule, which is if anything is not working, cut to Holly, because nobody wanted to cut away to me. So, traveling back in time, why a show about UFOs then? Why your interest in UFOs? Where does that come from?
Having heard the announcement about the United States Army Air Force recovering a crashed disc outside Roswell in 1947, that tweaked my interest, and it never really went away. And for many years, I tried to find information, and there really wasn't a lot there. And then I was in the Libyan desert and had a really bizarre experience. I was sleeping in a little pup tent next to my wireless vehicle, and woke up in a one-man tent. It was really heavy-duty canvas. I wake up and I'm in my sleeping bag because it gets cold in the desert, especially in winter. And there's this bright light lighting up the side of the tent. And I thought, what the hell? The guys on the vehicle are screwing around. They've turned the truck around and pointing the light in my tent. So I crawl out of my sleeping bag and out of my tent. And there's this huge amber light at eye level. And I'm shielding my eyes, trying to see around this thing, trying to figure out what it is, and walking toward it. And as I walk toward it, it backs away from me and up one side of a sand dune and then down the other. And I'm following it, still trying to see what the hell it is. And as my foot hit the flat sand, I woke up in my tent on top of my sleeping bed, covered in sand. And I was totally freaked. Just totally freaked. And I never talked to anybody about it for many years. And, I mean, I still don't know to this day what it was. And I was not dreaming. It was real. One moment I was trying to see what this light was, and the next moment it's morning and I'm lying on top of my sleeping bag.
I had never heard this story.
I don't tell it very often. My interest is legitimate.
Okay, you're in the desert, you wake up, and you've had this experience. What happened after that?
Well, I didn't tell anybody about it for a very long time. It's not a story I tell very often. My cousin was here from Australia. He's a nuclear physicist. And we're driving from Peterborough down to Toronto. I'm going to take him to the airport. A gray, rainy day, and we're driving down 11535 to the 401. And I'm nattering away. And back in those days, I had a little Volkswagen Rabbit pervertible. And I'm talking as I'm driving, and I suddenly notice that he's not paying attention to me anymore. He's leant forward in his seat, looking out under the surrounded the windshield and the roof. So I lean forward and I look, and there's this gray disc down below the clouds pacing us. And silence for quite a while, and eventually he says to me, "What do you suppose that is?" And I said, "Well, you're the bloody nuclear physicist. You tell me." And he said, "I'm buggered if I know." But this disc stayed with us all the way down, must have been 15, 20 minutes, till we got to the 401 and made the right turn onto the 401 and headed for Toronto. And it stayed with us, pacing, just slightly ahead of us up on the left. And we got to the outskirts of Toronto, and there's a hydro substation there, distribution station, and suddenly this thing sped up ahead of us, got right over the substation and went up the clouds, right angle, at an incredible speed. So that happened, and then I got my first computer. And then that led into the UFO intelligence bulletin board. And there were other sort of strange things that weren't UFO related at all that have happened to me over the many years. So it got me really interested again in UFOs. And then I had seen J. Allen Hynek when he was in Toronto. And that was sort of coincidental too. And it just all became part of my reawakening, if you like, my interest.
So when you look back now, all these years later, on the experience in Libya in the desert that night, you've had many years to process it. What do you make of it all? Because that's not a flying saucer. It's not a, you know, sort of a disc hovering above you. It's, some people would look at that. In fact, having studied religious history for many years, you can find many stories like that within religious texts, filtered through a different form of interpretation in different eras. So, you know, with all the passage of time, what do you make of it?
I don't know.
You don't remember?
Nothing. I remember waking up, getting up, going out there, trying to see what was behind the light, and then being on my sleeping bag, and it was morning. No idea. Interesting interpretations. I have a theory. Apropos of nothing.
As the kids would say back in the 60s, lay it on me, man.
Okay, dude. The virgin birth in the Bible. This beautiful angel comes down and appears to the Virgin Mary. And this young woman looks at him, and he's this beautiful, beautiful being. And they go and do dirty things together. She falls in love with him. He was described as an angel. Angels fly. He came down out of the sky, you know, seduced this young woman, and then said to her, "Oh, you're going to have a kid that's going to have superpowers." And what does she do? She goes back and she tells her husband, "Well, I met this angel, and he told me I'm going to have a miraculous baby." And I think that Jesus was the son of an intergalactic being.
You and Reverend Barry Downing. Have you ever read the Bible in flying saucers?
No.
You should, because that's, you know, what did Stan Friedman call him once? I interviewed Downing for, lovely fellow, for the Stan Friedman film, and he's got a PhD, I believe he has a PhD in biblical studies, but he also has a science degree. So he's kind of this combination. And yeah, that's his, the Bible and Flying Saucers, a classic of sort of the flying saucer literature. I think he wrote it in the late 60s. But basically the idea that you can interpret most of the stories in the Bible through the lens of extraterrestrial visitation. And it's not something you'd normally associate with Stan, for instance, but I have talked to Stan at length about this, and he actually sort of, in fact, I think I even put a podcast segment up where he talks about religion and the Bible and flying saucers, and he uses the story of Sodom and Gomorrah from the Old Testament. And he says, look, if you, and I think he took this from Downing, but if you look at what is described in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, he says, that could be a nuclear explosion. That sounds like a laser. That sounds like, and he just is assigning technological interpretations to what people at the time would have assigned, obviously, a supernatural interpretation. So here's a curious question for you then, because there seems to be an antipathy in many segments of the UFO culture, and I'm just going to call it the UFO culture, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but I could call it the UFO research community too. There seems to be a sort of antipathy towards spirituality, religion, anything that smacks of the supernatural, because an awful lot of people seem to be very keen on being taken very seriously by science.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
I agree with you. I don't know whether it's just merely a public antipathy, because a lot of the people that I've talked to off mic, off camera, are intrigued by a lot of the, you know, the magic, but really don't want to get into it in their public persona, or as their public persona.
Well, yeah, in Stan's case, and I certainly don't want to speak for Stan, although I've become quite good at doing it over the years, I suppose. You hear him give his lecture enough, you can pretty much repeat it verbatim, because it doesn't change a lot.
It's well honed.
It is. He's a good showman, and I mean that in the best way, not the worst way. But you don't hear him talk about religion in his lectures, and you don't hear him talk about the spiritual implications. You don't generally hear him talk about anything before 1947. But if you talk to him in a private sense, mm-hmm. you know, at a family reunion or wherever you might be talking to him, that's a different story.
Yeah.
And those things do come out. And I've always wondered about that, why a lot of these people are so desperate to be taken seriously by science when they're never going to be taken seriously by science. And as a result, they wind up ignoring some of the more interesting aspects of the phenomenon, including your Libyan case, which seems like a very, what Jacques Vallée might call a very high strangeness kind of thing. Yeah. Very high strangeness.
Mm-hmm.
And missing time and all of that other stuff.
Yep.
So if somebody was to ask you flat out, do you think you're an alien abductee? Do you think that was some kind of an abduction experience or maybe a contactee experience?
I think it's an experiencer experience. What and why and I don't know. I wish I did. I wish I was a John Velez in some ways that, you know, I would know what I knew.
Maybe we're not meant to know what we know, though.
Yeah, there's that to it, too.
I think that's the nature of the phenomenon. If it exists, and I remain an agnostic, but a lot of people seem to want to put an explanation on it. Maybe it's something that's just so strange and weird that we just get glimpses of it, but we don't get an understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a reason for doing a radio show about UFOs. Sounds like you might have had a reason for doing a radio show about all sorts of other weird paranormal stuff, too.
It was my assignment whether I chose to accept it or not.
Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. All right, Lisa, are you ready for this?
That what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc. UFOs over New York,
and I am too surprised. Well, the thing just hovered sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I saw it.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
When you were doing your radio show, Strange Days Indeed, what informed what the kind of guests that you were looking for? You didn't have to do five shows a week, obviously, like Art Bell or George Norrie, but you could have picked, you know, you could have gone in sort of the less serious direction.
But there was no point in doing it then.
Why did you pick the guests that you picked, I guess, is the question.
It depended on what was going on in the news, in the UFO news, and it depended on what interested me and what I thought would make interesting listening for the seriously interested listener, of which there seemed to be rather a large number.
I suppose you had a rotating cast of UFO fiends, as I'll call them. How did those folks get involved? Like Dick Hall, he was a semi-regular contributor for a while, I think.
He was he was 2 or 3 years.
Did you ask him?
I asked. I had him on as a guest.
Like Lemberg and Stuart Miller and all these people, did you bring them in or did they?
And Dave Frelott and all of them. It was all my fault.
Yeah. I always like listening to Alfred Lemberg, and I obviously like listening to Stuart Miller.
Yeah.
And Dick Hall, too, who was a good guy.
Yeah. Dick Hall was very articulate. Alfred Lemberg was a massive edit every time, like Don Edger.
Really? Yeah, I've interviewed Don a couple of times for television, and yeah, he's a tough edit. And he's a good guy,
yeah.
But he talks.
Yeah, and I remember hearing David Jacobs many, many years ago on CBC. And when I first started SDI, I thought he would make a great guest. And obviously somebody had had just a really ugly time with a razor blade and splicing tape on the CBC version of Jacobs that I heard. And a lot of these people are great writers, great minds, but they're like me. It's getting the words out, you know?
Is there anybody that you would have wanted to have on your show that you didn't get on your show for one reason or another?
No, I think I got everybody I wanted.
I noticed, well, I might have missed him. Maybe he was on your show, but when I took a look down, I didn't see Jacques Vallée there.
No, well, Vallée would have been the guy. But I got John Mack and I got Bud and I got all of those people that I really wanted. Vallée wasn't available for many years.
I guess when you were doing the show, a lot of the time he would have been on his self-proclaimed exile from the UFO thing.
Yeah.
You had a sort of semi-regular segment, it seemed like, with Steve Bassett.
Yeah.
From the Exopolitics movement.
Before the Exopolitics movement.
Oh, really? Before he got in?
Oh, yeah.
So what do you make of the whole Exopolitics thing?
Michael Sala, Alfred Lambermont, Weber are a pair of loonies. And Weber definitely should stick to his meds.
Yeah, he's a strange guy.
He really is. Michael Sala seems to have disappeared.
He does, doesn't he? You don't really see him at all anymore.
Mm-hmm. And Bassett, I think, has just, picked up the name, Exopolitics. I mean, which is not a bad name if it weren't for the crazies that were involved in the beginning. I wish him luck. I don't think, he can move that doomsday clock back and forth as many times as he wants. It's not going to make any damn difference. I think the only way I'm going to find out is when I die.
Well, yeah, no, that's an interesting perspective. It takes you back to that thing in the desert where, again, you can have these experiences. I have a lady at the supermarket checkout line who recognized me once, and she's checking me out. Not checking me out, but checking my groceries out. And it was late at night, and there was nobody else there, and she said, "You're the guy from the ghost show, right?" And she just starts telling me about this house she grew up in, where blood on the walls and, screaming banshee sounds and everything and things that we can't explain, which to me maybe means it's the same thing, just manifesting itself to us in different ways at different times. The idea that I've kind of come up with is that we might be dealing with some sort of intelligence, and this probably has to do with what I do for a living, that interacts with us in an almost artistic way, that it's almost a form of performance art for whatever reason. Whether it's trying to communicate with us, to impart some sort of message, whether it's trying to inspire us to be more creative, and I think these things do inspire us to be creative, or whether it's trying to inspire us to think without giving us the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Like a good parent would not just do the answers in the kid's math book, but they would try and inspire an interest in math in the child.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
It's eminently possible. I don't know. Anything's possible. I've experienced all kinds of strangeness in my life. Not just me, but other people keying in to something around me and telling me things that they couldn't possibly know. A really good friend of mine is a wonderful Glaswegian who lives in Port Credit outside Toronto. And he was involved. Are you familiar with Dr. Munro, who did a lot of work, a lot of research into out-of-body experiences?
No, not familiar.
The Munro Institute in Virginia. And they, with the work that they were doing with the OBEs, they discovered that they could communicate with spirits on the other side. And as a result of many, many years of work there, my friend Gordon Finn has written a couple of books, one of which is Eternal Life and How to Enjoy It. And he got a lot of the information that's in the book from the other side. But as a result of all the work that's been going on between the Munro graduates and the spirits on the other side, they have formed rescue teams. Whenever there's a major disaster, when hundreds of people die, all of these spirits are out of their bodies and wandering around, wondering, what the hell has happened? Am I dead? What do we do next? We're all here. Where do we go? And these rescue teams help cross over to the other side. Here, you want full circle? I was telling Gord about you wanting to do a documentary on me a few years ago. So I'm telling Gord this, and he said, oh, no, you should do it. It would make a great documentary. And I said, no, I don't need it in my life, you know? Who's going to write it? Me. I don't need it. No, I don't want to do that. There's enough about me around that if anybody's interested, they go listen or watch. So Gord kept on and banging on about my really needing to do this documentary. And eventually I said, look, I just don't want to do it, okay? And I don't want to talk about it anymore. So we continued on with our visit, and eventually he's leaving and he's going down the garden path. And he said, you really should do it. And I said, no, Gord, I don't want to do it. And suddenly he drops his chin, looks down to the left for a moment or two, and he says, Bruce said he'll do it. Bruce is my dad, whom Gord had never met. And then when my buddy and neighbor, Dave Pritchard, next door, he was another famous DJ in Toronto, a freeform DJ, and he produced the Beatles specials that you probably heard on the radio one time or another, and a wonderful artist, and he passed. And Gord had been, as a kid, had been a great fan of Dave Pritchard's on Chum FM. And I called Gord and I said, Dave died. And he said, oh, when I get a chance, I'll go see what he's doing. So a few days later, Gord calls me and said, well, I went to see Dave and he was tinkering away with a couple of turntables and stuff. And I said, oh yeah. And he said, oh, you must be Gord. I've been expecting you. So I looked at him and he said, yeah, Dave said apparently had been to see him and had told me that when Gord came, tell him that Errol was here because Errol said he wouldn't remember. And curiously enough, what I did remember was having a couple of peculiar dreams to do with Dave. So, you know, all of which is to say that there are things going on I just don't understand. Gord had never knew anything about my dad, you know, but that, and when I told my sibs later, they just all corpsed because it was so typical of him.
It's interesting to me, you know, I just like having conversations like this. In fact, I don't generally like trying to do a formal radio show or even a podcast. I can clean it up in editing, but I just like, this is the stuff I really like rolling through with stories and things like that because everybody has them.
Yeah.
And I've become fascinated. I think it's probably because I'm getting older, but I've become fascinated with NDEs, near-death experiences. I've always had an interest because, again, I'm an agnostic on all this, but my grandfather was a Reformed Baptist minister. There's certainly a religious element in my family's history, and I studied it when in college. That's what I did my graduate work in. And I've always been fascinated by people who have direct personal experiences with the other, and they call it God, but whatever. And so this idea of near-death experiences fascinates me. Is there, and I get, to me, it has to be, I assume it is for you, I think it is for everybody. I mean, the fundamental question that we all have to face at some time is, is there anything more than this?
Yeah, or do we just fade to black?
Yes, exactly. Do we just hear the national anthem and hit the test pattern, or are we on 24/7?
Yeah.
I guess. The older I get, I'm not a believer, but the closer I come to thinking that maybe it is 24/7 in some way, whether it's reincarnation and coming back or, you know, something. But when we go, it doesn't just end. Something continues on. And I drive my right-wing friends really nuts by imagining a socialistic paradise where we all join in a collective consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's now there's no more individuality. It's not like the Borg, but it's not where this consciousness is using us, but we're using we all get the best of everybody else. They go, you're a socialist. And I go, not really, but, maybe they have something, maybe there's something there that we should be paying attention to. As opposed to thinking as individuals, maybe we should be thinking more as a group. So that leads me, wait for this segue, here it comes. So that leads me into this idea of the global village and the internet, which takes me back to a question I did want to ask you about what kind of impact do you think the internet's had on ufology, the UFO subculture, the UFO research community over the last 10 or say 20 years from your own experience, but also watching it from a broader perspective.
I think it's raised the consciousness of the public a lot. I think it's helped a lot of UFO researchers communicate what they've found. I think it's brought out a lot of charlatans and a lot of loonies. But that's not just in the UFO field, that's everywhere. I think it's been a huge learning experience for humanity, hupersonity. It's going to be the fact that you and I are sitting here having this discussion, and at some point, or at some many points in the future, people are going to come along and hear us talking about what we're talking about. 15, 20 years ago, not possible.
It makes you wonder where it'll be in 5 or 10 years from now.
Yeah. I have a TV station and the phone that's in my pocket. I've graduated to my Galaxy S2 now, and it does the most astounding things. I mean, it also happens to make phone calls. It's almost like a phablet. You know, it's a large screen, does all kinds of miraculous things, which I love. And I love that for an old geezer, I'm still into all of this. I love the technology. As long as I'm around for the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, I'll be happy. I just want to see what's going to, where, as you said, you know, where's it going to be in a few years?
I just want to live long enough so that I can transfer to a cyborg body, which I'm trying to figure out which model, A, I can afford, and B, I'd want.
Leo Laporte did an incredible, as it happens, spur-of-the-moment interview with two scientists who are tinkering with the genome. And what a mind boggler that interview was at Twit TV, Twit Specials. It's stuff that you can only begin to imagine, and it's just around the corner, a matter of a year or two.
I'm going to have to start watching Twit TV.
Yeah.
Because it's all the kind of stuff I'm into, and I wasn't even aware that it was out there. It's the kind of stuff that Mac used to write about and, you know, look towards a post-human future or a transhuman future, depending on how you want to look at it. I asked a friend of mine, he almost always has a Bluetooth in his ear. And I asked him, I said, look, if you could have that cybernetically implanted in your brain, would you do it? And he thought about it for a second. He said, sure, why not? And I thought, okay. If you could have that cybernetically implanted, not though just so you can hear calls, I get that, but now other people can access your brain, like almost that shared collective consciousness kind of idea, would you do that? He thought longer for that one, and he said, well, I might not do the beta testing version, but, you know, version 2.0 or something, and as long as Bill Gates didn't make it, I'd probably be all right. But he said, yeah, I'd at least be willing to consider that.
Yeah.
To allow somebody, the way we share files now on the computer, to share your actual thoughts. And he said, yeah, sure, I can see it actually would make my job easier and stuff. And then he went on about how he would assume they would be able to build firewalls so you could keep certain information. And I said, well, what if they couldn't? He said, well, I'd have to really think about that. But he was at least willing to countenance the idea. And I thought, holy cow, I grew up with this guy. 20 years ago, this would have seemed like Star Trek to us.
Yeah.
And when we were kids, definitely would have seemed like Star Trek. And now, maybe it's something that'll happen in our lifetime. And if not our lifetime, his kid's lifetime, I'm pretty certain
mm-hmm.
that's going to be the going concern. I think the only thing you can probably say at that point is strange days, indeed.
Indeed.
There's a segue for you. See, every now and then I still go down. Let me, because I've taken up an awful lot of time, and I really appreciate that. It's just fun chatting.
Yeah, I'm having a good time.
You're a Canadian, which means you know what Reach for the Top is.
Yeah.
Because if I say to Americans, Reach for the Top, they just go, what? But Canadians all know the high school quiz show and everything.
It's a British show originally.
Was it? Mm. Everything we did was British originally. Stupid empire. Someday they'll get theirs. Someday we'll return and take over. I'm just going to run some short snappers by it, because this is how we'd always end Reach for the Top games. They just zap the teams, you know, quick little questions. Get your quick impressions, and I am not going to play name association. So I'm not going to go, what do you think of Stan Friedman?
Okay.
Cryptozoology.
Fascinating.
Bigfoot.
Also fascinating.
Do you think it's a flesh and blood creature?
I think it could be. Yep. Why not? There's a big study going on at the moment in one of the universities in the UK where they're looking at Bigfoot and Yeti hair.
Carl Sagan.
Should have kept to his own field and not interfered with abductions.
Michio Kaku.
Love Michio Kaku.
Is he our generation Sagan? Do they fulfill the same function?
Yes. Kaku is much more open-minded.
Wilbert Smith.
I think I would have liked Wilbert Brockhouse Smith. I have a feeling that he was telling the truth.
It's interesting because I've given a fair bit of stick to the late Wilbert Smith over the years. I was a harsher young man back then.
Yeah.
I honestly don't believe that he was privy to any top secret government information. What I came to find interesting about Smith was much more his interest in the contactees, his own claims of having talked to the boys topside and all that. That is what I eventually came to find interesting about Wilbert Smith. The much more out of this world kind of personal stuff. You actually had a son on your show once, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. James.
What did he make of his dad's experiences?
It was his dad. He fully believed him. He was there for a lot of this stuff.
Psychic phenomena. Do you think we have the ability to remote view, for instance?
Absolutely.
Do you think that's something that we all have?
Absolutely. I think it's inherent, and I think it's only a matter of sitting down and focusing, and anybody can do it, because I have.
You've remote viewed?
Yeah.
So much for the short snappers. So tell us about your remote viewing, because I find remote viewing fascinating.
I was involved with an organization in mind dynamics kind of thing. And one of the things that I learned to do and became a star performer for them was when people came in, you know, they were coming for a demo, an introductory lecture. They would come in and they would fill out cards of somebody that they knew, some, you know, ailments and symptoms. And I became really good at sitting up on the stage with my eyes closed, blackboard behind me, and out of a box of cards, pull one out. Somebody would take that card and write it on the blackboard behind me. All the symptoms, yada, yada, yada. And 99 times out of 100, I would nail everything that was written on the blackboard behind me and add stuff to the point where I'm sitting with my chin on my chest and I'm seeing things. I'm seeing Mary Scroggs in Omimi, and I'm looking inside her body, and I'm observing her, and she's allergic to cats, and she absolutely hates the taste of tea. And I'm hearing gasps from whoever had said it, you know, whoever had filled the card out. But it was a random pick, so I've experienced that. It's remote viewing. It's a minor form, but nonetheless, Lynn Buchanan, and, you know, I had him on the show. I had him on Mind Shift in the very last dying moments of the program. And as an afterthought, as the theme is rolling, and I say to him, have you ever viewed UFOs, remote viewed? And he said, oh, yeah. Did you find anything? Oh, yeah. Well, Lynn, we got to go. Goodbye. I know you can travel back and forth in time and across different dimensions, but all you got to do is sit down and do it. Huh? I mean, I can't prove that it can be done, but I can certainly sit down and do it myself and prove it to myself. And as for the rest of the people, I don't care.
Proper attitude. It's the one I developed about 2 years ago when I decided to stop trying to prove anything to anyone. Well, I've been talking to Errol Bruce Knapp, who I consider to be one of the, he won't consider himself to be this, his modesty will take over, but I consider him to be one of the most significant figures in UFO research and communication.
I always consider myself to be a facilitator, not a ufologist or a researcher, so thank you for seeing that, Paul Kimball.
Well, that sounded very strange days indeed there for a second when the way you say my name, the voice always goes up at the very end. I like that. That's how I was always, it's like being a boxer introduced. Paul Kimball.
In the red corner.
In the socialistic red corner, Paul Kimball. And in the blue corner, the blue beanies of Stephen Harper. So nobody outside Canada will understand that. Thank God. Yeah, no, people say they've called me a UFO researcher and stuff, and I go, no, I'm not a researcher. I fulfill the same function you did, which is I facilitate. I give people a platform to talk or be in a film or wherever and let them do their talking.
Yeah.
And I think, frankly, you know, in an age where ideas matter and we're trying to get ideas out, we have the technology to do it. That's probably the most important function. Well, that's very self-serving, isn't it? It's a very important function. You have to have those people, and they are few and far between on the ground, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So thanks very much, Errol. It's been great talking to you about your life, but also about UFOs and all that other stuff, and wish you all the best.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a pleasure. I've not ever sat down with anybody for 3 hours, although I don't know how you'll slice and dice this one down to whatever it is, but I've never done that. Not even on my own show. So thank you for the opportunity to do that, Paul.
And thank you for coming on. Always happy to break new ground for the man who gave us strange days, indeed.
Indeed.